playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Did you ever think you'd see the day when Met Éireann would issue a yellow alert, not for wind or rain, but for heat? Mind you, there are people who are vulnerable in any extremes of weather, and in particular are homeless people who have to spend so much of their day on the streets. Anthony Flynn, Chief Executive of Inner City Homeless Help, spoke to Sean O'Rourke on Monday as the temperature began to rise.
You know, we've an awful lot of people that are actually walking around the streets that wouldn't have access to water. There's no drinking fountains on the streets of Dublin, you know, so we've got to make sure people are hydrated and people are safe out there through the warm weather.
Yeah, and we heard about requests for donations of water and sun creams. Where can people bring those kind of things to?
The offices are open at 72 Amiens Street from 9 o'clock till 11 o'clock tonight and so forth for the rest of the week. And the teams will be actively seeing in the vans out on the street, engaging with rough sleepers and people that are on the streets of Dublin and making sure that they're properly hydrated.
Well, with temperatures soaring to over 30 degrees in some parts of the country, even the tar on the road started to bubble up and melt. And there were threats of fires as the fields and forests were kindled dry and farmers struggled to cope with livestock. Lorcan McCabe is a dairy farmer.
This year, in the last 9 months, I suppose we've got everything from the hurricane in the back end to the snow to the drought as we have it now. So, it's challenging.
I'm just wondering, Lorcan, I mean, you haven't quite said it, but I'm wondering, are you thinking it? You could do with a drop of rain.
Look, I hate even to be thinking that way. Look, I suppose people and ourselves, we enjoy the sunshine and not to take from it, but a little bit of rain, at night preferably, would do the world a good. And, you know, in contrast to the people that's homeless, you know, in Dublin, the amount of water they need, and it's very important. You know, cows, I'm not making any comparison, but cows, you know, it's 120 litres plus in this hot weather they need. So I suppose it's very important that that's done.
There are also concerns for the water supply, with Irish Water warning that it's on a knife edge and the company has asked the public to conserve water usage or it may be forced to introduce bans. Anne Kenny from Roscommon was listening to this and she rang Joe on the live line.
I had a letter from Ishka Water to say that I'm using 8,639 litres per day. And that was on the 22nd of May and I still haven't had anybody out yet to fix it. It's outside the gate.
And you can see it, obviously.
No, you can't see it, Joe.
Okay.
No, it's underground. And when they came to last week to listen to see exactly where it was,
yeah.
If you just bend down, you can hear it gush. And he said it's going under the road.
But you're saying you're losing
8,639. The average daily consumption is 125 litres per person. There's only two of us here, my husband and myself. The end of January or early February, I can't remember when, Joe, one of their little vans pulled up and he came in and he said, we're using a lot of water. Now, we only moved in here on the 16th of January and we didn't have a functional kitchen. It wasn't going. We only had a bathroom. So we never, ever heard from them at all until we got this letter on the 22nd of May. That's 5 weeks ago and we still haven't done anything. It's an awful lot of water, Joe.
Well, 78-year-old Marie MacDonald lives in County Dublin. She's struggling to cope in this hot weather. She hasn't had any water since March and she spoke with Morning Ireland reporter Aisling Kenny.
It's affected me bad because of the clot in my lung and not being able to shower. And it's really, I feel that the pressure is desperate on me now, you know, really and truly. As I say, I could go out the door and never come back. It's absolutely disgraceful. And I couldn't let it really go on any longer because I'd have to move.
Marie, who lives alone, says simple everyday tasks are a challenge.
I can't shower. I fill the kettle and I take it upstairs and try and wash myself in the hand basin upstairs. And being living on my own is worse.
What's it been like in the hot weather the last few days?
Oh, desperate. Desperate. I'm just sitting there. I don't even want to go out, go up to town or do anything. Only I went up to the senior citizens today, but I don't even want to go out. That's the way it's affecting me. I feel I'm just going to crack up.
And tell me, what have Irish Water said to you?
Irish Waters rang me and they asked to speak to Marie MacDonald. I said, speaking. He said, we're sorry about this. He said, we know where the leak is, but because it's in the backyards, it will not be a quick fix. And I said, so you're coming out tomorrow? Oh, no, he said.
78-year-old Marie MacDonald heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Well, over on the Today Show, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan was on hand with some useful advice.
Certainly in the eastern part of the country, and in the Dublin area particularly, things are touch and go in terms of the supply being adequate for the demand.
No, that's the real problem. We're consuming, the latest figure, 615 million megalitres of water a day, and that's above the actual supply. They're dipping into reserves. So I think we have to make a collective effort to get that down below 600, particularly at this moment.
So what are the things that people themselves ought to be doing? I mean, like, there's this talk of hose pipe ban, but if people have been putting huge effort into, you know, nurturing their flowers, their geraniums or their vegetables indeed, what are they expected to do? Let them all wither?
No, I have an allotment myself. I'm out with the watering can. But it's been clever about it. For example, I mean, there's no cost options where you do that early in the morning or late at night so the water doesn't evaporate. So you get the same effect, but you're just saving water that way. A lot of the obvious ones, typical shower running, you're 10 litres a minute. So having a 4 minute, 5 minute shower is a hell of a lot better than a 10 minute. You're saving 40, 50 litres straight away. Similarly, tap running, it's 6 litres a minute. So, I mean, simple measures. The Irish Water Pudding has very simple ideas. Put a jug of cold water in the fridge so you don't have to, you know, when you turn on the tap to get a glass of water, you don't have to let it run for 30 seconds or whatever. That's saving 3 litres. I think it should be a badge of honour now to have a dusty car. You know, do we have to have a car wash in this period? I don't think we do.
Green Party leader and TD, Eamon Ryan. The Minister for Arts, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, Josepha Madigan, was in the news this week after stepping into another ministerial role, this time in her local parish church. She's a minister of the word there, and when no priest turned up to say Mass, she and two other women stepped into the breach to lead the prayers.
I think it's really important that, you know, the church to me is the pinnacle of the community and the parish, and I want that to continue. But I do think that, you know, it would be helpful if the church, you know, I suppose, realise that people are still crying out for ritual and spirituality, but we need to involve lay people more. And it might have been better, for example, if there was training for us in a situation like that, where, you know, we weren't sure whether we could read the gospel or not. We chose not to in the end. We didn't do the collections. I mean, everybody pulled together and, you know, handled it very well. But I do think there's a bigger issue here. You know, I think the church should be ordaining women. I think it should be optional that priests can marry, you know, and it's something, if I get an opportunity to say it to Pope Francis in August, I will say it to him, because, you know, at the end of the day, we don't want the church to sacrifice its core values, which ultimately are the Ten Commandments, but it does need to adapt and it does need to make compromises now in terms of...
Yeah, and they would say as well... And we don't want to rerun the abortion debate, that one of the core values of the Catholic Church is the protection of human life. Now, you took a particular stand in the referendum. Did that present any difficulties for you, Minister, campaigning in a way that was in direct contradiction to the Catholic Church's official position?
But to me, Sean, it's not in direct contradiction, and purely because I would be of the view that God gave us free will, if we're going to go down the theological route, and I believe it's for everybody to make their own choice and their own decision. That's notwithstanding the fact that something, abortion may not be not something that I would choose, that's not to say that I should make that decision for anybody else. And that to me underpins the argument about that. I'm very much part of the Catholic Church. I want to continue to be so. And I think there are other people who share the same views. But really, the main point about this is that we get the laity involved across the country, because that's the way... The church is about the people, ultimately.
Would you like to be ordained yourself?
Who knows in the future, Sean? Who knows in the future?
Well, Minister Josepha Madigan got a good old-fashioned belt of the crozier for her utterances from none other than the Archbishop of Dublin, Gerard Martin, as Mary Wilson reported on Tuesday's Drive Time.
The row between Minister Josepha Madigan and Archbishop Dermot Martin is rumbling on this evening. Archbishop Dermot Martin issued a statement saying there was no shortage of priests in the Archdiocese of Dublin for the celebration of Sunday Mass, and that the priest's absence was simply the result of a misunderstanding. He said it was incorrect to say that the minister had said Mass, as reported in the Irish Independent. He continued, her expressed view that a mix-up in a Dublin parish on one particular Saturday evening should lead to the Universal Church changing poor teachings is bizarre.
And blame it on heatstroke or the silly season, but the controversy was still being discussed on The Gathering yesterday by Kevin Doyle, group political editor of The Independent, who broke the story, and Fine Gael MEP Mairead McGuinness, vice president of the European Parliament.
What the big mistake here was, Archbishop Dermot Martin's statement was totally over the top. He's a man known for keeping things calm within the church and often avoiding. He sees the PR danger around the corner. Yeah. And for some reason on this one, he took the bait and he fell right into it.
Was it taking a bait or was it reflecting a deep annoyance and level of upset at parish level perhaps? I mean, I think your own paper again quoted one of the priests in that area as being very upset.
Yeah, I spoke to Father Brian O'Reilly on Sunday during this and he was kind of saying it wasn't that big of a deal, but he confirmed there was some sort of a mix-up and people led prayers rather. Now, I did speak to him during the Dublin match, so I don't know how much time he was concentrating on me.
You could have taken a break during the Dublin match.
But look, there is a level of upset out there. There's no doubt about that. Josepha Madigan says she'll go back to do her reading in a month's time. She does it once a month, so it'll be very interesting to see what reaction she gets on the altar the next time.
Mairead McGuinness, what did you make of this?
Well, can I bring in the Lisbon Treaty into this? Because Article 17, which is dialogue with religious and non-confessional organisations, I'm responsible for that in the European Parliament. And to the best of my knowledge, I'm the first woman to have taken up this responsibility. So I'm very cautious about advising and saying what churches should or should not do, because I have to respect absolutely the church's position on all sorts of things. And the Roman Catholic Church is not the only church that has gender difference between men and women. So I would not comment as somebody with that responsibility about what any church should do, because I have this particular position. I did think when I saw the headline, Minister Says Mass, I said this won't end well. In our house there used to be a saying, I don't know if it was well known, that you know, if somebody was getting beyond their station, as they say, the line would be put out there, she'd take on to say Mass, which I think lots of people understand. On a serious level, I think Josepha Madigan is a great minister. Her faith is important to her, and I think that came across.
Mairead McGuinness, Vice President of the European Parliament. Meanwhile, over on Liveline, another Mass was making the headlines, the Mass in the Phoenix Park, to be celebrated by Pope Francis next month. Organisers of the event had made free tickets available online, but as part of a Say Nope to the Pope social media campaign, people who were opposed to the Catholic Church for various reasons began ordering blocks of tickets which they've no intention of using. Richard Duffy explained the background to the Say Nope to the Pope protest to Philip Boucher-Hayes.
So how many tickets for Phoenix Park do you reckon you've gotten at this stage?
About 692.
692 in your own name?
Yes.
How'd you do that?
I signed up for the maximum of 12. I did that three times, and then somebody pointed out that if you say you're organising a coach service to bring people up, you can book 8 coach loads of tickets and up to an 82-seater. So I've done that once so far, and that got me over 600 tickets in one swoop.
And you have no intention of printing any of these off or passing them on. What is your purpose here, Richard?
Well, there is actually talk of when I print a kind of a symbolic few to organise an event and burn them.
But what's your purpose?
Basically, drive home the message that people in this country are not happy with the Catholic Church, and this is a way of expressing that.
And you know of other people who have done it as well?
Yes, there's the Facebook page Say Nope to the Pope. A good few people have been commenting and talking about how many tickets they've been getting and signing up.
And is your ultimate objective here that if you were each able to get, on average, 1,000 tickets, that 500 of you would do this, and that ultimately Pope Francis would end up looking out at an empty field? No faces, no seats, no nobody.
That would be pretty amazing.
Gerry McArdle, good afternoon.
Hello, Philip Boucher-Hayes. How are you?
Very good. Tell me, what do you think of what Richard Duffy's doing?
I think it's tawdry. I think it's tacky. I think it's cheap. I think it's petty. I think it's spiteful. I think it's nonsensical. I can't believe that a grown man would stoop so low, especially in this country that recently has voted in 2 referendums for freedom of choice. That's what we voted for, freedom of choice. I voted yes in both referendums. I am a Catholic, by the way. I won't be going to see the Pope. I couldn't care less whether he comes or not. But the man is coming. He's a distinguished guest. He's a VIP. He's the leader of 1 billion people, you know? And to insult the man like that, I just think we're showing ourselves up, and the people who are doing it are showing themselves up as being a pack of Neanderthal paddies. So there you are, Philip. That's my opinion.
From Tuesday's Liveline with Philip Boucher-Hayes. A special collection of poems by Seamus Heaney was published this week by Faber and Faber. It's called Seamus Heaney, 100 Poems, chosen by the Heaney family. And the poet's widow, Mary Heaney, and his daughter, Catherine, were Sean O'Rourke's guests on Thursday.
When he died, Mary, the country paid a great tribute to Seamus. But as you said, I think yourself, you had a very public grief. That must have been difficult and perhaps remains so even 5 years on.
In an odd way, it made life simpler because it was so public. I couldn't give in. I have to say I was in shock anyway because it had been such an unexpected and sudden death. But since you are in the public eye, you have to hold yourself together. I had amazing support from my family and from my siblings and the letters, of course, from thousands of people. So I felt supported in my grief.
As Catherine Heaney explained, the idea for this book was not a new one. The poet himself had discussed it with his editor, a trim selection from 12 original collections that would represent the entire sweep of his career. But because of circumstances, it fell instead to his family to choose the work.
The immediate family, Mary, Michael, Christopher and Catherine, you sat down and read all the work. But how difficult is it? I mean, did you have, like, was it 25 poems each or how did you divvy it up?
Yeah, exactly. There was quite an unpoetic method to it all. At one point, I produced a spreadsheet of our choices. What happened was we all went away, took maybe a month to read all the poems ourselves, came back with our choices. And what was lovely was that I would say three quarters of them, we had all independently chosen the same one. So the kind of persuasion and negotiation came in on those last 25 poems and deciding what would stay in and what would go out.
A bit of horse trading.
A bit of horse trading. And at that point, we actually had a really lovely meeting where the four of us came to Mum's house and sat around and went through the books and read them and made that final selection.
According to Mary Heaney, 100 Poems is not an in memoriam volume, but rather a celebration of the extraordinary person who gave us these marvellous poems.
It's very good for the general reader because, as someone has already said in the Times, it's really a life in poetry from his very first poem to his very last one. And so you get a lovely grasp of his work.
And revisiting the love poems, was that the toughest part of this exercise?
It was tough, but sort of I was very, very proud as well. And anyway, a good poem doesn't belong to any one person, not even the poet.
Yeah, but you've got a trove of what, half a century of poems?
Yeah. Yes,
she's very lucky.
Very lucky. And Seamus was a very honest poet. You know, it wasn't always you're the most beautiful, wonderful person in the world. You could see we had a very real relationship, but they are wonderful love poems.
And I suppose maybe for younger people or for anybody really, it's a fantastic introduction.
Absolutely. What I like about it is that, you know, for someone who maybe has never picked up his poetry, doesn't know where to begin, here's a way in that anyone can really pick up and dip into. And then for people who have been reading his work over the years, it's a nice kind of way to reconnect with it. And what's been lovely is that, you know, fellow writers, of fellow poets, of dads have been in touch already just to say for them how special it's been to come afresh to the work, to listen to it, to read it.
Catherine and Mary Heaney, who also told Sean about a new exhibition which celebrates Seamus Heaney's writing, drawing on manuscripts and notebooks held by the National Library, and you can even see the desk that he wrote on. The exhibition, Listen Now, Again, will be open to the public at the Bank of Ireland on Dublin's College Green from next Friday, and admission is free. Former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was back in Dublin town last weekend, and the presidential hopeful, knocked off course by Donald Trump, appears to be well and truly back on track. But old wounds run deep, and she was still far from impressed by President Trump, despite his climb down on the policy to separate children from their migrant parents who are trying to cross the border from Mexico into the United States.
I think what he concluded is that the optics looked bad for him, and Republicans who are going to face the voters in November were telling him, you got to fix this because people are organizing against it in my constituency and this could backfire.
Right.
But if you listen to what he said that they would go back. But here's what I am just incredibly focused on and worried about. They've already separated 2,000 children. Now, some of the children are in places that are easy to go recover them, but I don't believe they have a very good system for matching children and parents. They have just scattered them all to the four winds. And there are a number of very young children who've been sent all over the United States to be put into foster homes. These children can't speak for themselves. I mean, I was reading the online news this morning, and 3-month-old babies, 8-month-old babies, 2-year-old babies, you know, they can't speak for themselves. They can't really say where they last saw their parent and where that parent was picked up and where that parent may now be detained or maybe having been deported. So I worry that a significant number of these children will not be reunited with their parents. And that would be an immoral stain on our country that we did this.
Well, as you know, Hillary's husband, Bill Clinton, has co-written a thriller with best-selling author James Patterson. It's fiction, of course, but well fact-checked, as Hillary put it. But we all know that actually truth is stranger than fiction.
There's an expression in Ireland which says it's a very small country where someone knows somebody, somebody meets somebody, and you go, sure, it only happened in Ireland. It could only happen in Ireland that you're here on the same day as James Comey. And it's a small island.
Does he may think I'm stalking him.
Anyway, he's knocking around somewhere. And here's my question. Like, if he passed you by in the street and said, hey, do you want to go for a beer or a coffee or something? Would you say yes, or would you say, I'm kind of busy right now?
Well, that's a tough question for me, honestly, because he clearly dramatically affected the outcome of the election. And his explanations up until now have been, to me, unconvincing, and I think to many others. So I think I'd wait on that. Yeah. I think I'd say, you know, I'm a little busy right now. Let's see how it looks in the future, because I'm hoping that, you know, we will get more clarity about what really happened and why and what kind of pressure he thought he was under that led him to do what he did, not once but twice.
Hillary Clinton with Ryan Tuberty on Monday. Well, it was a week for powerhouse women on the Tuberty Show. The head of the IMF and former French finance minister Christine Lagarde was fascinating on her family background and what makes her tick outside the economic and political bear pit. She credits her mother with teaching her how to balance the books in life and work. And she described how during the student protests in May 1968, instead of taking to the streets, she took up synchronized swimming and became a member of the French national team.
Do you apply some of the lessons you learned from synchronized swimming to this very day?
Sure.
Mostly what?
Hold your breath.
And?
Greet your teeth and smile. I think that the team approach to life is something that is very much with me.
Okay, let me ask you about these things and if they're true or not. But among the other things I've heard is that you twice applied for the civil service and failed the exams.
Yep.
That you were told once that you would never make it as a partner in the law firm because you are a woman.
Woman. Yep.
You defied all of these things. Whatever about 2018, but whenever you are hoping and ambitious to be a partner in the legal firm and somebody says, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen, Christine. Forgive the informality,
sure,
but
sure,
you understand.
Sure.
It's not going to happen. So dream a different dream. What makes you say, no, I refuse to accept that. That is not a truism.
Well, I thought, you know, sod you. You don't deserve me. And I'm going. I'm not staying with you. And I'm not going to work in an environment where I'm only contributing to your bottom line and you have no prospect for me because I'm a woman. So I just packed up my things and I left. I left that interview on the spot. When I remember the staircase, I run down that staircase. I was out in the streets of Paris. I was free and I was thinking to myself, I'm never going to work for those guys. No way.
Where did that come from? Where did that confidence and self-belief come from?
You know, I think it's a combination of the education that I was given and the role model that my mother had been. You know, to see her thrive in all the skills that she had, sometimes face the adversity and the contempt and the sort of hidden agenda of some people, because it was hard in those days, you know, to raise a family of four as a single parent. Single parent families were not very highly regarded in those days. Mm-hmm. If you were a widow, it was a little bit better, maybe. Yes. But if by any chance you had, you know, friends in addition to your family to care for, well, then that was very much frowned at. But my mother couldn't care. She was determined. And I think I must have learned that from her.
Christine Lagarde also spoke about her friendship with the late Brian Lenehan and the atmosphere in this country prior to the bailout crisis when she was the French finance minister.
When Ireland were going through the horrors, when the recession was kicking off, the banks bailout was happening, you were on the other end of the phone at one point to Brian Lenihan, who was the finance minister of the time, the late Brian Lenihan. And he spoke, as he told a journalist after the event, en français to you. And you developed a friendship or relationship with Brian Lenihan.
Yeah.
And I understand that it was a difficult time. Did it feel chaotic at your end of the phone at that time?
You know, he was, first of all, he was a very nice colleague, a very very congenial, very friendly, and he spoke good French as well. So we often sat next to each other and spoke French when we could. But on that particular day, there was a sense of absolute panic, and having exhausted all the options and having looked at all the alternatives and simply saying, you know, I'm at the end of my list of choices. I've totally explored all the tools in my toolbox, and I have no option but to guarantee all the deposits. And that was, you know, all of us were in unknown territories at the time. It was just unbelievable.
Was it sad?
I don't think that we had time for sadness. There was just too much going on, too much urgency, too much of a sense of, you know, will it work? Is that the right thing to do? Are we not taking a massive risk? On the other members also affected, going to instantly rush to the banking system. But it was a very confusing time. But no, we didn't have time for sadness. We tried to roll up our sleeves and do as well as we could in times that were so uncertain.
The head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, heard on the Ryan Tuberty Show on Tuesday. There was a lot of history across the airwaves. Ryan had a terrific interview with Dr. Gillian O'Brien yesterday. But did you know that this week in 1891, Charles Stuart Parnell married the love of his life, Catherine O'Shea? And historian Diarmaid Ferriter gave a tour de force summary of the love affair that destroyed his political career. Catherine was married to Captain William O'Shea, who enlisted Parnell's help to further his own political career. In time, he'd cite Parnell as co-respondent in his divorce case, hell-bent on destroying him, but not because of Parnell's affair with his wife. Their marriage was long dead by the time Catherine met Charles at Westminster. Rather, it was because he was, in the words of Diarmaid Ferriter, an odious character.
Of course, you know, Captain O'Shea had outlined the adultery that had been committed by Catherine, and he gave all the dates and places where herself and Parnell had been lovers, and there had been numerous addresses. They had eventually three children together, Parnell and Catherine. So there was all that. But she had counterclaims, of course, that he had habitually committed adultery with diverse prostitutes, as she described it, that he had been reckless and rash with speculation and horse racing, had squandered money, had been abusive and violent to her even when she was pregnant, and had committed adultery with her own sister, Catherine's sister.
All hell broke loose after the court case, and despite valiant efforts, Parnell couldn't defeat the forces of church, state and media aligned against him.
He begins to unravel, and you can see physically that this fight back is destroying him. He loses the party, the support of the party. There are two bitter by-elections in Kilkenny North and Carlow. The Parnellite candidate is defeated very heavily. He was described by a contemporary journalist as being haggard, chain-smoking cigarettes, making gesticulations and gestures that were just not normal for him.
Took its toll.
He's haunted.
And Catherine wasn't spared either.
John Redmond at the time, who later becomes leader during those intense rows in the House of Commons committee room, insisted Parnell was the master of the party, to which one of Parnell's opponents responded, but who is the mistress of the party? And Catherine O'Shea's name was used in that context. She becomes Kitty. Kitty wasn't her name. Kitty was Victorian slang for a prostitute. And that's why Catherine was referred to as Kitty. She was regarded as meddlesome, as destroying Ireland by destroying Parnell. And you've got to consider, I suppose, the toll that it took on her also.
But their love was unshakable, and their story would give any Hollywood romance a run for its money, as one astute texter pointed out.
Her, for Parnell, was everything. And even when you consider their final hours together, he was a gravely ill man by that time in October 1891. He goes back to Brighton where they're living. He gets into bed. He has the Irish setter, Catherine, on the other side with her arms around him. And he says, "Kiss me, my sweet wife, and I will try and sleep for a while." And he closed his eyes, never to open them again. She called a doctor in the middle of the night. The doctor confirmed that Parnell was dead. But she remained by his side throughout the night. She kept whispering to him, hoping in vain that he might respond to her. And then when he's placed in the coffin, she put the rose that Parnell had given her at their very first meeting on top of his breast so it would be buried with him forever. And she doesn't go to his funeral. She never sets foot in Ireland. And Parnell's funeral is a massive public occasion. In the region of 200,000 people attend that funeral. Catherine's not there.
Historian Diarmaid Ferriter, a regular contributor to the Today Show with Sean O'Rourke. Amy Gilligan was just 11 years old when she was raped by a 16-year-old family friend who was babysitting her. He was prosecuted and pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 5 years in prison with two suspended. His name was added to the sex offenders register. Last year, Amy found out by chance that he'd applied to have his name removed. She was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Tuesday and she told him about the enduring trauma the rape had caused her.
Well, as a child, I guess I always counted myself as being very different from other 11-year-olds. I couldn't really talk to people about what had gone on. I guess, like, in a way, losing your innocence at 11 years old, having to grow up being different from everybody. Throughout my teen years, I experienced bullying because, like, people would have found out what happened. You know, kind of comments like, oh, don't touch off her, she'll get you sent to prison. So that was another factor of it, like, you know, a knock-on effect, people finding out about that and having to go through that as a teenager.
Despite great support from family and friends, Amy continued to suffer from anxiety, self-harm and trust issues. And when she heard in her hometown of Athlone that her attacker had made his court appeal for removal of his name from the sex offenders register, she wrote a letter to the judge and got permission to attend the hearing.
So the letter was very diplomatic. It was very personal. I gave kind of a step-by-step account of being an 11-year-old child, to being a teenager, to being an adult. And then the last paragraph was basically explaining, it's not about me anymore. It's not about him. It's about setting, you know, like setting something here for other people, you know, who've gone through similar experience. Like nobody I've spoke to yet has been aware that you can appeal to come off the sex offenders register. So going back to the letter, so I just explained, like, you know, how it affected me as a child going into my teenage years and then how it affected me as an adult.
Yes. And how would it have affected you had he been successful in his application?
I guess I would have felt that justice was undone. I feel that I have, you know, I have struggles, I have anxiety. They're my crosses to bear for the rest of my life because of what he did to me. I have issues when I meet new people, trust. I'm always on guard. You know, if somebody gets too close to me in a public space, I kind of, you know, I clam up, I move back. But him being on that register should be his cross to bear for the rest of his life.
And can you envisage any circumstances? And I said at the outset, you know, this is not about revenge. It's not about identifying him.
No.
But could you envisage circumstances where somebody who would have committed a crime as bad, as serious, as egregious as rape could or might be permitted to have his name removed from the register?
The only way I can see that being, you know, like if somebody is being removed, OK, if we talk about a situation where somebody is in a nightclub, they sleep with somebody who's 16 years old. They don't know, you know, they don't know. And then they end up going to prison for statutory rape. Mm-hmm. If it's a case like that and somebody genuinely does not know that they have slept with somebody who's under the age, OK, down the line, you know, if they go to prison, all that kind of thing. I think, you know, having it in place for those kind of reasons. But if you have somebody who is, you know, who has committed a crime against a child, children are the most vulnerable people in our society. So I think somebody like that should be monitored to prevent them from slipping under the radar.
And another point, I suppose, is that am I right in thinking that you found out about this appeal he was taking really by chance? You know, as you say, you found out in the grapevine, but you had no right to be told, did you?
No, I had no right to be told. And that's I guess, what the amendment I want to the Sex Offenders Act 2001 is, that the victims are taken into consideration because our voices will always matter. Mm-hmm. You know, he can move on with his life. Any offender can move on with their life. But at the end of the day, if they're going to appeal to come off a register, you know, we should have our voices heard.
Amy Gilligan, a brave fighter, heard on the Today Show. Well, the appointment of a new Garda Commissioner was announced unexpectedly on Tuesday. Drew Harris, Deputy Chief Constable of the PSNI, becomes the 21st Garda Commissioner since the foundation of the state and the third Garda Commissioner in the last 4 years. He's also the first appointee from outside the state. His appointment was discussed on The Gathering yesterday by journalist Alison O'Connor and Mairead McGuinness, Vice President of the European Parliament.
Mairead McGuinness, is that something that you were surprised by?
Gosh, I think it was quite an appointment. I was absolutely surprised and very happy when I read about the appointment, which was done by an independent body. From what I know of this man, and it is just what I've read since his appointment, he has a huge experience in policing. He has a very tragic family experience because of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And I think he'll bring a great deal of wisdom, I hope, to a very, very difficult job, because he's not walking into a police force that is reformed and now fit for purpose. He's walking into a police force which has to face reforms, and he knows that and he has to lead that. So I just wish him well. I think it should be a really interesting appointment. Well, and I'm disappointed by Sinn Féin, I have to say. I thought
In what sense?
Insofar as they were very quick to kick.
Well, in they a way said they would be keeping a close eye, calling him to account. But I mean, it's not just Sinn Féin, Alison O'Connor. There are people who say, look, this man, because of his previous position, I mean, all likelihood has access to information that this state has sought for a long time in regard to events like the Dublin and Monaghan bombings, the Miami massacre.
Look, I can well understand the upset, and I heard a lot of it myself on the airwaves. And yet my reaction, I think, similar to what Mairead was saying, was one of kind of shock, but also thinking this is a really positive thing. And it was even fascinating to read that currently people at his level in the PSNI, you know, have an armoured car or whatever, and that he'll still have that down here. And it's interesting to note that he'll come in as an outsider, and even that will set him further apart, and that he has a really big job of work to do. I thought Sinn Féin's remarks really were ill-advised, and you put on top of that Mary Lou MacDonald saying that she didn't think Gerry Adams was in the IRA, and you just think, why is she at that? She's had a fabulous couple of months, and to pull herself back into that sort of scenario, which would make it even more difficult, you know, for Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael in terms of a coalition. She stood by Gerry for long enough. She's the leader now.
From the gathering yesterday. Well, Brexit was in the news all week. Cian McCormack brought us a new series, Opinions from the Border, on Morning Ireland. And over on the Marion Finucane show, Brendan O'Connor discussed the implications with celebrity chef and businessman Richard Corrigan.
Let's get back to you and Brexit. Are you finding problems with staff in London? Are you finding problems with customers in London?
There is a nervousness in the financial sector. I mean, we really cater for a lot of the financial sector in Mayfair in particular, you know, and I certainly, talking to my clients from the city, they're very nervous. They are talking in the city that if this doesn't go well, there's minimum 75,000 jobs will be lost in the City of London. The European Medicines Agency that is moving from London, some statistics for you, they book 130,000 bedrooms. They use 190 or 200,000 meals in restaurants. Just taking that out of London alone is going to affect London. So, you know, the restaurant business in the last year and a half has been absolutely, well, I use the word shell-shocked. Restaurants or companies are closing. Jamie's from Conran closed three this week. The Gay Hussar in Soho, which had been there for 50 years, closed. One of the great left-wing bastions of where the All Used East, just closed on Thursday. And it's just one after another. And I've never seen it. You know, all the big middle market chains are absolutely being crucified. There's a change. You know what I mean? And I don't know where the change is going to stop. But yeah, I'm an optimistic guy. I'm doing all right, I'll be honest with you.
How's your Labour of Love fucking Cavan going then?
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know what I mean? Really, it's... You know, I just came in yesterday afternoon. I walked the gardens. You know what I mean? We went all around the whole place. It's, when the sun shines and you walk, you know, in your own gardens, it's beautiful. And some great food, from courgette flowers to sweet corn to all our cut flowers. All our potatoes down, all our roots are down. You know, sea kale is all just about finished. Grapes coming on, the apricots, peaches ready in another few. Tomatoes, broad beans, peas. So, you know, it really is a big horticultural operation.
Richard Corrigan with Brendan O'Connor on the Marion Finucane show. The Kildare versus the GAA All-Ireland football saga was surely the 2018 version of the Garth Brooks concert Willie Won't He Play Crow Park story. On Monday's Morning Ireland, the GAA Round 3 qualifier between Kildare and Mayo was drawn live. The first team out got home advantage. So far, so simple. So how did Kildare and the GAA end up in a big standoff? On Monday, Kildare manager Keane O'Neill really dug the heels in.
We were drawn first out of the bowl. The rules clearly state that the first team drawn out has a home venue unless they're playing a Division 3 or 4 team. And that's exactly where we're going to be on Saturday night. We'll be in St. Conlett's Park. We're going to be togged out. We're going to be ready to go. That's our home venue. We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road. And that's not going to be taken away from us.
So finally on Wednesday there was a breakthrough. RTE's Gaelic Games correspondent Brian Carthy was on the case and gave the details to Pádraic Lodge.
You clearly felt that yesterday this was never going to go the legal route.
No, in my view, there was never any danger of it going that way because a solution was there all along. Kildare were not going to play the match against Mayo anywhere but Newbridge. That was abundantly clear from the time the draw was made. The stance was strong. Therefore, it meant Croke Park officials had to concede on this one or face the PR disaster of Kildare turning up for a game in Newbridge and Mayo, their opponents in Croke Park. GAA Director General Tom Ryan, Uachtaráin Cumann Lúcadh Gael, John Horden and senior GAA officials were never going to allow that situation come to pass. It took longer perhaps than it should, but in the end, right call was made.
Are you hearing anything, Brian, about how this deal was brokered?
Well, yesterday evening, high-ranking Croke Park officials and representatives of the Central Competitions Control Committee travelled to Kildare to meet with members of the Kildare Executive. That meeting lasted about 2 hours, Pádraig. Both parties obviously outlined their positions. Kildare were not for moving. There was a meeting then of the CCCC this morning, and based on the outcome of negotiations last night, a decision was made to move the game to St Conlon's Park in Newbridge. So no doubleheader in Croke Park. Brewster Park will now be the venue for the Cavan-Tyrone clash. Ultimately, the correct decision was made. Once Kildare made that stand, there really was no other option. Kildare had earned the right to have a game, a home game, and that has now eventually come to pass. But Pádraig, the search is on now for tickets, and the capacity of St Conlon's Park is 8,200, and season ticket holders will all be catered for, and based on Mayo's larger allocation in that regard, there'll be more Mayo supporters, I presume, in Newbridge than Kildare. But now at least, thoughts can turn to the game itself. Kildare emerged victorious in the boardroom, and the big question now is, can the players deliver on the field of play in St Conlon's Park?
Well, may the best team win. RTE's Gaelic Games correspondent Brian Carthy reporting for Drive Time Sport on Wednesday. But I leave you now with a new song from Villagers, Conor O'Brien, who sang live on the Today Show on Thursday. Gurmahagov Aswar Golúther, Gudian Tachtan Chahugin, Takana McKenna, Gudjeshab Slán.
My heart is spilling over, crashing on me.